The Sunday Morning Linux Review, starring Mary Talmage, Tony Venus, and Matt Anders as the Beaver.
That's right. And this is Tony Venus,
Matt Anders,
and Mary Talmage.
And this is episode 145.
We're back.
It's back.
Yeah.
It's back.
we're also back.
Yeah, but yeah.
For better or for worse.
Right. That's in reference to Crunch Bang.
Yeah. So it didn't stay dead long.
Right. Because our last episode was
Ode
to Crunch Bang, and now it's Welcome Back.
Yeah, there's that song, Welcome Back. Come on, Matt. I know you can do it.
No, because the only thing that's going through my head right now is the Welcome Back Cotter theme song.
That was it. That was it.
That wasn't the real song, though. That was the one that was on the radio, was it? They adapted it for the show.
Oh, I was thinking of the Cotter song, yeah.
Okay.
For those of you who are not old enough, never mind. We'll move on. all right, Tony.
All right. Yeah.
All right, well, I'll tell
Tony
you what I did.
I have no idea what we're talking about.
That's right. Well, you gather your thoughts because I know you're over there. Not only is Tony participating, but he's controlling the soundboard and he's doing all of that technical stuff.
Not only is he a participant of the show, he's also the engineer.
That's right. And Matt and I are just the pretty faces. But anyway, I'll just start off. You know, I think on our last show I mentioned I had signed up for that Python programming course. I'm happy to announce I'm still in it.
Are you current in it though?
Yes.
Because technically I'm still in the edX I signed up for too, but haven't done a single thing.
Yeah, no, this one. I have vowed to complete it, which will be sometime in April. I've already written my first Python program.
Ooh, more than Hello World.
That's true. I wasn't even going to say that. But yeah, that was my very, very first one. But I wrote another one, and you just simply stick in a Fahrenheit temperature and it converts it to Celsius.
Ooh.
Hey.
I think I can do that in Bash.
I'm sure you can, and probably a lot more. But anyway, so yeah, next week we'll be getting into functions, although I've used a function already when, you know, you accept the input from a user. There's a function called, I think in Python 3 it's called input.
I do that with the read command.
In Python 2 it's called raw underscore input. And then, so that's what I did. The other thing is that I... Well, and we'll get into this later in the show. And I spent some time reading a book. So.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so we'll be talking about that.
Yes, in our half book review.
That's right. You know, and that's what I'm calling it.
I know, I saw.
Yes, I'm in our half book review. But
it'll be the whole book. Right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm reviewing both halves. although there is a natural break in the book as far as content. So, and we'll talk about that when we get there. And the only other thing I did is, those of you who follow DistroWatch know that Netrunner just had a release and they are now defaulting to, KDE, Frameworks 5.x series. I think it was 5.2. So I thought, oh, I want to take a look at this. So I downloaded, Netrunner and just fired it up, fired the live CD up. And from a user perspective, I know underneath the hood, there's a lot of changes for developers and things.
Yeah, but you
I mean, to
don't
extend
see
it forward.
At all from
the only thing that I really noticed is
your CPU usage put off the chart?
You know, I'll tell you, for the live CD, it seemed to be a little faster, I'm using my Bemis hosting testing laptop.
All right.
Yeah. The one with the Broadcom chip, Tony.
we forgot about that. We told you we'd replace it, didn't we?
No, that's fine. I did that for the joke value. But anyway, they are now going with more of a flat theme. And so and Tony, actually, I thought of, Cinnamon when I looked at their menu because there is some resemblance there. So I took a look at it and, but that's what I did.
All right.
That I care to talk about.
What I did was WordPress. Pissed me off so bad because I don't know how
that you
many
bought the company. No,
oh my! If I could go there and kill them all with an axe, I would.
that's a good joke.
But if you've ever used WordPress and tried to make it bend to your will, forget about it. Tony, you use WordPress a lot.
Yeah, I do.
Did you ever try and adjust the white space margins on the right and left?
Yes. And it doesn't work very well, does it?
Oh, my God. It's a freaking nightmare.
Is it?
And yeah, I spent literally 4 days trying to adjust the margins to the way I wanted them.
Mm-hmm.
Could not do it. So I gave up, threw WordPress away, hand-coded my site in straight HTML, and that's the way it is, and now there's content, because I'm done fighting with WordPress.
Well, what was, I mean, the problem primarily is that you could make the adjustment, but you couldn't save them?
I can't make it look the way I want it to.
What it is the theme that he's using, there's multiple parts, and each of those has a border or an edge.
Mm-hmm.
And if can't you're you editing get the CSS? One or the other, it's, yeah, in CSS. So, and because they're all in divs. So there's the main content has a div. Then the sidebar has mm-hmm. a div. And then the entire page has a div.
Oh,
and,
yes.
And then the post has a div. So you have to go through and check every single one to make sure it spans out, because the post, or you might expand the entire page and the entire content, but not the post. And so the post would stay smaller than the rest of the page.
Yep.
And
it was just a nightmare. Yeah, I could not make.
If you're good with CSS, then go for it.
Yeah, but I could not make WordPress bend to my will.
Mm.
So it's done.
You're dead to me.
So now I have to. So I don't get comments now, because I have to figure out a way to still get comments.
There is a way. Somebody was telling me about it the other day. I'll look it up for you.
All right.
But
excellent.
What you do is you throw in some, I think it's JavaScript that you throw in there, or maybe it's an iframe. And it there's another service that runs all your commenting, but it shows up on every single page just like
excellent.
It would.
I be able to? Is there some way to hold them for
moderation?
I think
moderation
so.
So that I can get rid of the spam.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is.
Okay.
Yeah. Huh.
Excellent.
So you won't get those beauty supply emails.
Oh my God. No, but I'm thankfully done with WordPress. So.
Okay.
And if any of you want to check it out, there's now a little bit, just some content on bashjunkie.org. So if you want to go there and check it out, it's there.
Good.
All right. So my 2 weeks have been busy as normal with regular family stuff and trying to unpack house. And then I decided to go ahead and build my PFSense box. I took an old shuttle computer. And actually, if you're watching the podcast, the video, you can see the very bottom of it up above Matt's head.
Sitting on top of the switch.
There, yeah. How's that look? Just like the weather, you know?
That's right. That's the very bottom of it. And it's running, I looked on their page and they said you need a minimum of like a 500 megahertz processor.
Is it 32 or 64 bit system that it's running on?
I think it's a 32 bit.
Oh.
And it's a minimum of, or no, it said if you have a 500 meg connection out to the internet, then you mm-hmm. need at least a 2 gig processor. And I looked at the specs on this, and it's a 2.6 P4
right.
with a gig of RAM, and I'm like, hey, that's great. And it's a gig of hard drive space is all you need. So I took out the hard drive because the hard drive was loud in that. It was an old, like, 20 gig drive.
Oh.
So
that is old.
That is old.
I took that out and I got one of those compact flash adapter to IDE
mm-hmm.
and a compact flash card, and the pair was like $20. And then it was giving me issues, wouldn't boot, because the BIOS was hanging because the compact flash didn't have the right whatever format
flags or something.
Partition table that I was looking for.
Yeah, the boot flag wasn't set properly, right?
No, it just wouldn't.
Couldn't you just DD what was on the hard drive over to it?
The whole BIOS would hang. The whole computer would hang.
Huh.
It wouldn't get past checking that hard drive.
Huh.
Or compact flash, what thought was a hard drive.
Right.
Anyway, so I got, the way I got around that is I unplugged it. It got past the post and then plugged it back in. So when PFSense booted for off the CD, then it would recognize the drive and install to it.
Oh, okay.
So it was before you had anything installed to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then because I did it that way, it wrote everything to the drive, but when it went to boot, the BSD boot manager didn't see things right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't boot to it. It kept on just
because it couldn't find it.
Couldn't find it.
Okay.
So now, but now that it had the partition table on there, then the BIOS was okay with it. So I just ran the install again and everything was good.
Oh, excellent.
Oh,
beautiful.
Nice. Yeah.
So instead of learning how the BSD boot manager worked, mm-hmm. plus trying to figure out how to get in there to edit it, that would have taken
hours.
What
do they use as a boot manager?
I have no clue. The PSN.
I use Grub.
Boot manager.
Yeah.
She says Grub, so.
I was gonna say, I thought it was Grub.
Well, it's PC,
than Grub.
I think PC,
PSN may be
PC
different.
PCBSD uses Grub, yeah.
Anyway, so, got that installed. And then, for
so
the last 2 weeks.
So are you filtering packets now?
I got all the way up until, yeah.
Cool.
All the way up until 2 days ago, I've been fighting with it, and I finally figured it out. That, because I have two things I want to forward through, or three things. I want to forward, so I can SSH into my box here. And I have own cloud running, so I want to get to my own cloud, which was on 443, so it runs over HTTPS.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have my Plex server I want to get to. Those are the only three things I want open to get in.
Mm-hmm.
And with I have ATTUverse, and everything would work great except for my own cloud. It would start, I would set it, and I would test it here, and it would work great. I would take my phone, I would take it off my Wi-Fi, like as if I'm coming from the external,
mm-hmm.
and it would connect great. And then I'd get to work the next day, and it's not connecting. Nothing's working. I'm like, what is going on?
Wow.
And I fought with this for almost 2 weeks. And then I finally did some Googling, and...
See, guys, I would have Googled the second day.
Well, no,
it's like asking for directions. Oh.
No, and really, I thought somebody was trying to hack into my system because, mm-hmm. every time I would connect, instead of giving me my cert that I created for my own cloud, it was giving me some mini something web cert.
That was from the Uverse box, wasn't it?
No. And so that's where I started Googling it, and I found that, whenever you have a wireless receiver with your UVerse, they put in a separate access point.
Yes.
And that separate access point is the UVerse, your modem, automatically forwards 443 to that. And I saw that, and I'm like, I'll just change it. And I changed it like four times throughout the week, and then finally I Googled it. So I ended up changing my own cloud port to a different port, and now it's working. I couldn't tell if it was pfSense wasn't showing right or if it was.
So do you have this in front of your AT&T box or behind your AT&T box?
The AT&T box is the modem, so I can't have anything in front of it. So it goes ATT. And then the internal ATT stuff, so all my UVerse stuff is plugged into that, and what I'm going to call my guest internet,
mm-hmm.
is they can connect to the ATT box. And then all of my internal network is, it goes PF box, PF sense,
mm-hmm.
and then it goes, noises and words. So it goes ATT, PF sense, and then the internal, I have my switch and my router, or my switch and my wireless access point.
Right, but you have your internal wireless from pfSense.
Yeah.
Set up on the Red network, right?
No. No, because I want to. My internal is, I want that to be. I want to be able to get to my own stuff. I don't want it to be separated. So
yeah,
I don't give anybody, except for you two, are the only ones that have that password now to get on that. Nobody else is going to get it. They're going to get the ATT.
The guest
network. Internet. And that's on the red side of my pfSense.
Right, right. Normally, this is what they recommend, is that all your wireless should be in the red zone.
Yeah.
So that you can't access any of your internal servers from the wireless.
Right.
Just because wireless is breakable.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I understand that.
It's the weakest link.
Right. And if I was running a corporation or something, that's how I would have it too, but
Cause at work we're that way?
Mm-hmm.
Also?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like if you're on the wireless, you can't connect to any of the internal network stuff. You have to be on the wired. And then, mm-hmm. but we also have not only are, do we have that, but then we also have a guest network for when we have visitors.
Well, you guys are sort of ultra hardened also. But being a
we are PCI compliant.
Yes.
Anyway. But if somebody was on the wireless and they VPN'd into it, that's different?
Yes.
Okay.
If you're on our wireless and then you would connect through the VPN.
Wirelessly?
Yes.
Okay.
Then you would be able to access the
right.
internal.
Because at that point you're a VPN user, not a wireless user.
Right.
Ah,
even
okay.
though you're using the wireless to get to the VPN, you're a VPN user.
Yeah, because, you know, when I...
Because all your traffic is encrypted by the VPN.
Yeah, because when I was working in, you know, doing that software stuff, that knowledge management software, that was one of the things that customers couldn't get to their knowledge management stuff if they were wireless on their network because of the way it had been set up.
And, right, because they were in the red zone.
Yeah, exactly. And I knew at the time that was the problem, and so we could let them know, hey, you're going to have to be VPN'd in order to access that resource. But they somehow thought, again, this is at the user level, not at the IT level, that they should just be able to get on their wireless and be able to get to it.
No, because it's the red zone.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't appreciate
especially
the whole,
being law offs, as you would. Think that they would have that drilled into people.
Well, yeah, but you know, attorneys, I'd say they have, we got minds of their own.
I follow Popet.
So
he's a pretty with it attorney. He plays D&D.
Yeah, but not all of them are. Yeah, but you know, their interest is in the law, not technology necessarily, although some are very technically oriented. But you know, that's in the past, so.
Yes.
Okay. Wow.
That was pretty much it.
All right.
Okay. So, yeah. Wow, that was a good discussion. I learned a lot there. I guess we're going to move on to...
Yeah. Well, you know what? Just the moral of my story is, if you have UVerse, you can't forward port 443. Also...
Well, if you're using a UVerse wireless, you can get UVerse without the wireless.
You're right. If you're using the wireless thing, they put a box in there that they open ports to. So you may not want any of your own personal stuff inside... The UVerse side, you want it firewalled off again.
Oh, I connected a separate router to UVerse, and yeah. So I do it that way.
Yep. Yeah. And that's, in essence, what my pfSense mm-hmm. is doing.
Yeah, because it's a router.
Yeah.
So. Cool.
So, because UVerse can look at your whole network.
I know, and that's why I got my own router. I thought,
exactly.
You're
that's
not
why
looking
I
at any of my crap.
I used to do it, too. I used to put them behind a router and run a separate router.
I told them that, too. Because they said something to me, you've got blah, 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 and I'm thinking... That's none of your blankety blank business.
They did the same thing to me, and I went out the next day and bought a router.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
All right. So, I guess we're ready to go.
That concludes the tinfoil hat segment.
Yes.
And then on to...
Matt, what's happening with the kernel?
The kernel. So, the main line is at 3.19, or 3.19, which was released on 2.9. And the newest stable kernel is 3.18.7, released on 2.11. And the newest long-term kernel is 3.14.33, released on 2.11. Then we have a long-term kernel 3.12.38, released on 2.19. Long-term kernel 3.10.69, released on 2.11. And long-term kernel 3.2.67, released on 2.20. And that's all for the kernel news.
Hey, no, it's not.
It isn't.
No, I have a question for you, Matt.
Okay.
Did you see the discussion this week about whether, you know, there's going to be release, whether they should roll to 4.0 or go to 3.20 or whatever it would be next?
Yes, exactly. And did you see my... Because Linus also posted on G+ about it.
Yeah, I saw that. And then he put a poll so you could vote.
And I voted for the 4.0. And did you see my comment about the 4.0?
No, because there were so many. There were hundreds of comments.
That's why I told you it was the 55th one down.
Okay. Oh, I remember when you said that. Yeah,
yeah, you
right.
told me that.
Did I tell you?
Yeah.
Okay.
I made some comment. I made some funny comment about that, but I never went and saw it.
Right. So. No, yeah, and my vote was for 4.0 because it's going to, this kernel, when it's released, is going to include hot patching.
I think that's significant enough
think
to warrant.
That's exactly what I said. I said, I think hot patching is definitely significant enough to warrant a 4.0 release. So.
I hope he takes your advice.
I do too.
All right.
All right.
It's on to.
Good. Yep, on to.
Tony, what's going on with the Linux distributions this week?
The distros for this week. So
yes.
We're going to go back to the 9th and start with the NST, which is a Network Security Toolkit 20-6535. And they are a distro based on Fedora with a set of tools for network security testing. I went to their website and I'm like, how? When you first look at their like development tools or whatever they use, it looks like it's a surveying one. You know, there's a bunch of mapping programs. But then, right, if you go back to the very top of the page and actually read the text instead of just looking at pictures.
Still looking at the pictures. I liked how you laughed at that, Tony. That was funny.
It has a link over to, it says, the top 25 security tools by insecure.org. And it looks like, and that's what they're including in this. It says the majority of the tools published in this article are available in the toolkit. And it looks pretty interesting. There's things like John the Ripper and TCP Dump and Metasploit and Kane Enable and Wireshark and a lot of good
Snort.
Stuff. Snort, that's right. And Nessus. I have no clue what that is.
Oh.
Aircrack.
Nessus.
Backtrack.
I used to know what Netcat. That was. I've never really used it, but I read about it once. And I slept at a Holiday Inn Express.
Did you say Backtrack?
I did.
Okay.
Backtrack? Kismet, there you go.
Anyway,
it's kind
of
nice how
cool stuff.
And isn't it nice how they organized it too?
I suppose. Why?
Well, I liked how they've got it set up. I mean, sometimes when you go to a site and you're looking at stuff, it's just you have to really dive in to try to pick stuff out. But these guys have got each tool set up separately.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, it's pretty nice.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing too that's included. Oh, I'm sorry. That's it. Oh, that's it.
It's on the sectools.org.
Okay, excuse me. I didn't realize you were on a different site. But the other thing too is that they've got in this release, NST has got the display of a dynamic lat and long grid for Google Maps. So you can drop coordinates and things on.
All right.
Right.
Well, all right.
Then next up we have. Is Kali Linux 1.1.0.
The long-awaited.
That's right. This is just a point release.
Yeah, but it took them 3 years to put this point release out.
Oh, yeah?
Did it?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yes.
Wow.
It's also a specialist for software tools. For
it says it right there on the page. You don't have to go anywhere, Mary.
Right. Okay. And forensics.
You were so... You said that with such conviction. I thought it can't be true.
Did you say 3 years?
Yeah.
It says almost 2 years.
Yeah, and then read the next line.
out loud.
I don't. It says after almost 2 years of public development and another year behind the scenes.
Well, 2 plus 1. Okay, we get it, Matt. We get it. It just took us a little longer.
I have to add while we're broadcasting.
I know. Not only does he have to read and be the engineer, but we're forcing him to do
to
math.
To do multiplication.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sorry. I never said I could do math.
Multiplication is just simply sequential addition.
Oh, there you go.
All right.
Oh, I like that answer. That's good.
Yeah. Well, that's when I was trying to reduce mathematics to its simplest.
Me and the network engineer got into a discussion. I don't know why I get into these discussions with him. About how basic math is not mathematics.
It's arithmetic.
Like addition, subtraction, multiplication, and division is not mathematics.
Right.
What is it? Arithmetic?
I don't know. Finally, we agreed to call it a component of mathematics.
hey, remember the Beverly Hillbillies? What do they call it? Figurin or?
Figurin, yeah, or something like that.
All right.
All right, that's our signal from Tony to move on.
All right.
next up we have is the UCS, or Univention Corporate Server 4.0-1. And it's their first point update for the Debian-based enterprise class server.
Yeah.
And we've talked about it in the past. They have a bunch of cool stuff for corporations like Active Directory integration and and other stuff like that.
Yeah, but, you know, one thing, if you do download the free version, you have to opt out of the anonymous usage statistics that they collect. So, and they tell you how to do that. You have to dig down into some little checkbox on some screen someplace. But if you don't do that, then you're basically going to be sending anonymous usage stats. So I guess that's the payment in exchange for using the software for free.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Right. Who would not opt out?
Who would not opt
out? If you're running this in a
corporation. Which means, that's a double negative, which means who would stay in?
Exactly.
Look, I had to do it that way because when you have two negatives, you have to really think about.
It's not two negatives.
Who would not opt out? Opting out to me is a negative saying.
But it's not.
Yeah.
No.
Yes, it is.
No.
Okay, anyway. we're going to agree to disagree. Yeah. I can see this going nowhere.
It's who would not, comma, opt out. It is not a double negative.
Anyway. So, no, I agree. Because if you're running this in a corporation or inside with anything, you don't want it sending data out
but if you're
like,
in a,
among...
Right. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Who would not opt out?
But time out, though. This is only for the free version. If you sign up for their corporate version... That's not part of the mix. This is basically in exchange for it.
Right, but still, who would not opt out? Who would say,
people
yeah,
can't
go ahead,
find...
you can have my anonymous stats that aren't really anonymous, and you know who I am.
People who can't find that little menu item, who don't read the fine print, who don't read paragraph 92 of the EULA.
I always, every time, because I sent away for two quotes on different things last night, and they're going to send me these quotes via email.
Mm-hmm.
And at the very bottom, there was a checkbox that's pre-checked for, oh, send me all the newest updates on your latest shit.
Right.
And you have to I always look for those boxes.
Yes.
Because everything's got them.
Yeah.
Kind of like when installing Firefox or something, the Ask toolbar, yeah. The Ask.com toolbar or something. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, I agree. All right, going on the 13th, we have Robo Linux 7.8.1 KDE Edition.
Yay.
Robo Linux, we've talked about them in the past.
Oh, yeah.
Debian with KDE.
That's right. They make things easy for the former XP users.
That's right. All right, next we have Rebellion Linux 2.5. And they said with a set of distribution, with a choice of Mate or GNOME as their desktops.
Mm-hmm.
No.
It's also Debian 7, the Synergy edition.
Yeah.
They have two. One is the more cutting edge. And I think that's
right.
The adrenaline.
Sid. Yeah, Sid is the adrenaline.
The adrenaline, which kind of makes sense. They also inadvertently omitted Bluetooth support in the Synergy Mate version, so, which they acknowledged, and I suspect we'll probably see an update very soon with it.
And now they'll probably fix it with a patch.
Yeah. And also, they did add, for the Rebellion Synergy release, they added a support page inside of it for faster support. So you can, I guess, if you've got a question, you can get to it a little more quickly. So.
All right. Next one we have on the 14th was Parsix 7. The official name is Parsix GNU/Linux 7.0R1. And they're based on Debian 7 with GNOME as a desktop.
GNOME, all these GNOME people.
This is codename Nestor.
Ooh.
Do you know where that came from?
No.
Their names are... Sounds like you know, Matt.
Just go on, Mary.
Okay. Those releases are named after characters from the movie Happy Feet. Remember the dancing little penguins? Those fuzzy penguins.
Right. And do you know why they do that?
Oh, no.
Because what are Debian releases named after?
Toy Story.
There you go.
Okay.
All right.
Cool. I wonder what they do when they run out of characters.
Those movies have so many insignificant, like, one-thing characters that they'll never run out.
Right.
Especially Debian with Toy Story. How many Toy Story movies were there? Three?
Okay. Yeah. Probably. And, you know, they're, by the way, before we move on to Parsix's 64-bit edition supports UEFI boot and installation. The support, though, is still experimental. So but they want you to report any issues that you encounter when you're using it.
All right. And on the 16th, we have Netrunner 15, which they're the desktop based on Kubuntu 14.10.
You know, and that surprises me because Netrunner's the company that, when Canonical kicked Kubuntu to the curb, they're the ones that picked it up, right? And they sponsor the Kubuntu distribution now also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's Netrunner and Kubuntu. It's from the same people.
Mm-hmm.
And Netrunner's based on Kubuntu? At some point, wouldn't you just roll Kubuntu upstream, and I mean Netrunner upstream into Kubuntu? Or do away with Kubuntu and make it Netrunner? I mean,
I thought that's what they're going to do also.
I did too. I thought they were definitely going to do something like that, and it just hasn't happened.
I don't know. You know, Netrunner just changed their default login manager to SDDM, which is a simple desktop display manager, and
stopped using KDM?
Yeah, they did. So, I don't know. I know Kubuntu uses LightDM, which I think is from, you know, the stock Ubuntu.
Yes.
So I don't know. Maybe one is, I don't know what they're going to do. That's a good question. Yeah, so. And the other thing too that they did, Netrunner, is they split, as far as the audio applications, they split radio, they've got a music librarian, and then online searching and music into three dedicated applications. So, you can, access those, you know, as separate. I don't know if they were together before, but it just sounded a little odd. So, that's why I'm going to quit talking about it right now.
Okay.
All right. All right. Next up we have is Black Lab Linux 6.1. Mate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the last show they had, Black Lab had a release.
Yeah, because they're one of those distros that breaks their different desktop editions up so that they have a Mate release, and they have a KDE release, and a GNOME release.
Yeah.
Ridiculous.
Exactly. That's why PCBSD, they came out and they had five different things embedded in their desktops embedded in one
right.
release.
That's the way it should be.
All right.
Hey, one thing though, I will give that distro props for though, pre-installed are apps like Scribus and OpenShot, which, maybe OpenShot is a little bit expected, but Scribus, that's not something.
Yes, it's not very expected.
So. Okay.
Who would use that other than desktop publishers?
That would be about it. Dabblers. Right. Dabblers like moi.
All right. On the 17th, we have Frugal Linux 2.0 and general purpose desktop distribution for intermediate and advanced users.
That's right. As they say on their site, for those who are not afraid of text mode.
There you go. The command line. Learn it, love it, live it.
Yeah, well, actually, and you know, they list the system requirements for to install. And one of them is a fearless attitude toward text mode. And then they've got it available for 32-bit, 64-bit, and then for ARM. So,
all right. Also on the 17th, we have Bodhi Linux 3.0.0. So this is the next major release based on 14.04. That's the Ubuntu LTS. And they have a customized Enlightenment 19.3 as their desktop.
Yeah, they said that as far as upgrading, they said any users who are on a pre-release version can just simply upgrade. But if you're on a previous major release, you're going to need to reinstall. So I guess, but the fact that this was on hiatus for a while.
Well,
wasn't it?
No, but that's because Bodhi. Bases them on the LTS versions. Mm-hmm. And you can't just go from one LTS to the next LTS because there have been so many releases in between them.
Oh, good point. Yeah. Mm. Yep.
Yeah.
So.
But they're going to support that previous version, which I think was 2.4 until April of 2017, which I think is a standard. Isn't that the standard?
Sure.
3 years. Did you say 17?
Thanks for humoring me, Matt.
Did you say 2017?
That's correct.
Yeah,
2 years.
2 years from now, but
yeah.
3 years from the LTS.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We got that figured out.
All right. On the 18th, we have Clonezilla Live 2.3.2-22. And that's their latest live CD for Clonezilla. It's based on Debian's Unstable Branch. And it's really good for disk cloning and a lot of stuff. I used it a lot with when I would put together laptops to sell and stuff. I would install the system on one and then just clone it over using Clonezilla.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I used it a lot too.
Yeah.
And with this release, they have a new feature.
Oh, yeah? Yeah, that's right. they can
tell
clone.
It, Tony, tell it.
You can now clone the Chromium and Chromium OS drives.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
I don't know why you would want to do that, but you can.
But you can. For some people.
Because any Chromebook, you can reset it right back to factory stand, right back to like it, you just took it out of the box.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah.
Mm.
And so, but it would be nice for Chromium, because is it Chromium, the OS, you can run it on other hardware, right?
Well, people have also booted Chrome OS, too, their own hardware, too.
That's actually what I'm thinking about setting up for my kids.
Yeah, because I'm in the
Chrome OS.
I'm in the Chrome channel on Google Plus.
Mm.
Oh yeah.
Is that a busy one?
Yes.
Okay.
All right.
The only other thing too, they did remove a couple of packages, Refit and GPT Sync, just because they're no longer in Debian, and so they follow Debian and they pulled them too. So.
Mm. Right.
All right.
Next up we have is Proxmox 3.4 virtual environment. And they, what is it?
The email gateway or what?
Oh, this is the virtual environment.
So
this
oh,
is
I'm
the
sorry.
Right, right. Gateway. This is not their email gateway.
Yeah. So it's Proxmox. It says, the new release features the out of the box ZFS storage support along with Hotplug and NUMA. Which is the Ununiform Memory Access Support.
Nice.
Non-uniform?
Open ZFS. Oh, the most important piece of that is the Open ZFS.
Yeah. Do they warn you about RAM usage?
I don't see anything in the release.
I don't know. Maybe it's a footnote.
Because you got to understand, ZFS is great. I love ZFS. But if you're going to use ZFS, you got to have a lot of RAM. A lot of RAM.
How much?
A lot.
Although, Matt, ZFS is really built for like really large file systems, right?
Dozens of terabytes.
Yeah.
So if you have, 30 terabytes of data, wouldn't you, I would assume that you would have a server running with more than 8 gigs of RAM. A typical server
16.
Has 16 and 32 gigs of RAM.
Well, our entry-level dedicated server starts, I think, with 4.
And do you run ZFS on it?
No.
No. Exactly. What's the size of hard drive on
ZFS
that?
I'm running ZFS on this.
Gig?
It's got 4.
I think
4.
A single 500 gig drive.
Yeah. Okay. That's one exact.
All right.
No, but ZFS, is even if you're not running a large file
system,
it's really cool.
Did I tell you I love my PCBSD laptop? I'm loving it.
Yeah. You're running ZFS on that, man?
Yes.
Yeah, that's what it installs by
default. How much RAM do you have in it?
Four.
4 gigs RAM.
Well, keep in mind, I'm not.
Slow.
That's why it takes so long to boot. No, keep in mind, I'm not taxing it that much either.
Right.
So there's not a lot of I.O. Any way you look at it.
Oh, I had a server go down last week because of I.O., actually.
Oh, really?
Turns out it had a bad hard drive.
Ooh. Oh, now see, with the...
Was it one of those 3-terabyte drives?
Could you do a hot swap? Was it like RAID? Could you do a hot swap or something? Or
it was in RAID.
Okay.
But it was behind a SAS card instead of a PERT card.
Oh.
So we couldn't tell exactly what drive it was. So I gave the DC guys, the hardware guys, I told them which serial number it was. So what he should have done and didn't do... was he said, I think it's this drive. I'm just going to swap it. And he swapped it out and swapped the wrong drive.
Oh, jeez.
So then they had to wait for the rebuild to finish from the failing hard drive to the new hard drive.
Oh, my gosh.
Before they could actually swap the bad hard drive out.
Oh.
It was kind of funny.
Did you?
For me.
isn't there like a option in the management of that card to go in and
there is
say,
no management of that card, really. Those SAS cards are real basic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So.
Okay.
All right.
If he'd listened to me and read the serial number, taken the drive out and read the serial number, and said, oh, that's the wrong drive, and put the same drive back in right away, would have taken almost no time to rebuild. How much data could they have missed in the short time he had it out?
Not much at all.
Exactly. So...
Why did they do it that way then?
Because he was confident that he could tell which drive it was.
The one that was rattling?
I don't know.
Oh my God. See, it's the ask.
The things that happen in the DC behind your eyes. That
behind
you don't
closed
ever
doors
see.
At the data center. Tales from the data center.
Right.
Oh my gosh. Oh, that would have been a good one. Well, we're getting it out a little bit later into the show. But, all right. That was good, man. All right, Tony, I think we're ready to move on.
All right.
This is going to be the longest distress section ever.
I know.
I am only going to do half a review so I can get out of here. All right.
All right. On the 20th, we have Lin Hess 8.3, which is a specialty distro based on Arch for set-top boxes and home entertainment computers.
Have you ever tried it?
No, but it says this one's running Kodi, which is the old... XBMC.
Mm-hmm.
So I've used that, you know, and it, that's pretty nice.
Okay.
I saw something about Plex in here. Mm-hmm. Now includes the option for Plex Home Theater, and Kodi has been updated. So it looks pretty cool. I just haven't used this specifically.
Okay.
All right. Next up, we have also on the 20th is a Ubuntu update. For 14.04.2, so an update to their LTS. And the last one on the list, also on the 20th, is ClearOS 6.6.0 Community Edition.
Mm-hmm.
And ClearOS is based on CentOS, but it's for the cloud-connected servers and gateways.
Yeah, they got a commercial version.
Oh, do they?
Mm-hmm.
So the community edition is designed for homes, hobbyists, and small organizations?
Mm-hmm.
All right.
You want the real stuff, you got to get the commercial one. And it'll cost you a little bit, I think.
I'm sure.
Okay.
All right, so now we're going on to the top five from the last 7 days. All right, number five, we have OpenSUSE with 1393.
And trending up.
Number four is Bode with 1481.
And trending up.
Number three is Debian with 1720.
And trending down.
Number two is Ubuntu with 2047.
And trending up.
And then the number one spot is Mint.
Gotta love that minty goodness.
With 3175.
And trending up.
It's really making hay there.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And
because it's awesome.
FreeBSD is at.
Oh, thanks, Matt.
You're welcome, Mary.
Already getting my segment out here. Yeah, where is it?
26.
Yep, and it's trending down.
Up.
Oh, good. I guessed, and of course, as luck would have it, I guessed wrong.
And PCBSD.
Uh-huh, 37?
37.
And trending down.
Yes.
By mistake. All right. So there we go. And now it's time.
Now it's time for...
What distro are you reviewing this week, Mary?
Actually, this week, it's not a distro. This week, and actually this episode, it's our half book review. That's what we name it. We do review the whole book.
Most of the time.
Yeah. I think you should, why don't you give me that book and I'll take care of the rest of it for you.
All right.
All right. Well, this episode's half book review is, Networking for System Administrators by Michael W. Lucas. And,
excellent.
I know. When Michael W. Lucas approached me about reviewing his latest book, I jumped at the chance. Whether you're a professional system administrator or someone who just dabbles, a dilettante like me, or simply connects one or more computers or router to the internets, you've interacted with a network. Although naturally this book focuses on the men and women who maintain systems and servers for a living, anyone who's curious about their home network or just has a natural curiosity will find this book useful. Note that Mr. Lucas covers networking in Windows, Unix, as well as Linux. So, I mean, this book he's got a broad audience here. He's aimed at a broad audience, and I think that really increases its effectiveness because some people might have Linux when at home, but maybe at work they're, you know, sysadmin or Windows environment.
Windows world, yeah.
Yeah, so. Anyway, in the first chapter of the book, which is appropriately named Chapter Zero, The Problem, Mr. Lucas lays out the situation. Essentially, it's this. Due to the specialization and complexity of the enterprise, it's difficult to know everything about everything. This specialization can lead to a blame game when something goes wrong, and it's not always a network guy's fault when your server
Yes, it is.
It's going to be that kind of review, eh, Matt? When your server isn't properly communicating. Lucas asserts that by learning some basic networking principles and applying them as needed, a system administrator's troubleshooting effectiveness will increase. It's a far better strategy than simply throwing up your hands and claiming the problem is with the network, like Matt does. No, I'm just kidding.
It's always the networking guy.
I added that a little bit.
It's always the networking guy.
That may be the case, but after reading Lucas's book, you won't be embarrassing yourself when it's not. And according to Lucas, that network administrator might actually like you. Hey, Matt, does yours like you?
I think we have a fairly equal love-hate relationship.
Okay. All right, the book is divided into two sections. The first six chapters discuss networking technology that system administrators should know, and the second half of the book, chapters 7 through 12, invites system admins to roll up their sleeves so they can actively check the systems they maintain and evaluate the results of that check before they contact the network administrator. All right, let me see here. I'm scrolling up here. I just lost my place. Isn't that terrible? Okay, here we go. No book on networking would be complete without a discussion of the network stack. You know that stack?
Yes.
You know, every time
usually
I
comes
have,
with cheese on it.
Yeah, every time I every time I get, I'm at a, like a picnic and there's a seven-layer salad, I always think of networking.
The OSI model, that is hilarious. I never thought of that. That's great.
Yeah, my sister makes seven-layer salad.
Now we have to, next show I will have each layer of the seven-layer salad coordinated with an OSI layer.
There you go, Matt. That'll be good. All right. But Michael W. Lucas he doesn't make any adjustment actually because the TCP model kind of takes the last three and bundles them up into the application layer.
Correct.
So anyway, and he talks about that. But the OSI model, I mean, it's more academic than anything else, but it's still important to understand
it. Because I mean, one of the layers is hardware. Come on.
Yeah. He mentions that too. Yep. So, while we've already talked about the fact that TCP rolls that. So, it rolls it into that single application layer, including HTTP, SMTP, LDAP, and some of the services the system administrator manages. As an overview, the chapter conveniently includes a table listing some of the troubleshooting tools for each layer of the stack. Now, further into the book, he's going to take those tools and really jump into them and show you various options depending on what you want to filter, what you want to check. So I found that to be very useful. And I also discovered that if you don't pay attention when you're looking at a tool name and you think you're using the BSD version and you try the Linux version, you're going to get results that you might not expect.
Yes. Did you see my post about tar?
Yes, I saw that.
It's
you know
wild.
What I almost did? I almost posted a download link to FreeBSD. Let's see. In a section called Layering in Practice, Lucas takes a simple web page request and shows how each layer participates. I found that to be now some sysadmins are going to know that already, but I think for somebody who may not be as familiar with it, they're going to appreciate how he steps that packet through all the layers, what they do, whether they're, you know, helping it push it along or, you know, whatever it happens to be. I'm not going to go into detail.
I just have one question.
Yeah.
Is
how long is my review?
No.
We're still on chapter, we're still on chapter one.
Zero, I thought.
No, one is the network layers.
Oh, okay. So, is there going to be a section of this book that will help me with SYN flood attacks? I had another one the other day. They're a pain in my ass.
I'm sure there will be. That's my answer where, I'm not really sure, but he does, No, because I think, well, I'm not, you know, there may be, because he talks about,
I had to get the networking guy involved, and then he just null routed that IP at the firewall. Above the server, so.
Well, maybe that's, he should just show you how to do it, and you just automatically do it.
Well, no.
They're not going to let him do that.
They're not going to give me access to that piece of equipment.
Oh. All right, well.
And then I'll take all of Australia offline.
Oh, wait.
Crikey.
Should have been 12 instead of 13.
And now I can't even get into the box anymore.
Oh, my God. Okay. Well, anyway, Chapter 2 focuses on Ethernet, the ubiquitous local area network protocol. As expected, Lucas covers... Notice how quickly we got serious there. As expected, Lucas covers various aspects of the protocol, including things like speed, duplex fragments, MTU, ARP, to name a few. I found his brief description of including MTU... adjusting it. He provides some useful advice regarding setting the MTU if you need to. One size doesn't fit all necessarily.
Huh.
It should be really set on a network basis. So ping, one of my favorite commands, makes an appearance in this chapter. Lucas shows how a non-response from the pingee, that's my term, doesn't mean the host isn't on the network. It just means you didn't get an answer. And that's a perfect segue to ARP, the Address Resolution Protocol, and its IPv6 counterpart. You know what it's called?
The IPv6 version?
Yeah.
No.
Ping 6.
Ping. ARP.
Why?
No, it's called Neighbor Discovery.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Will you be my neighbor? Oh, Mr. Roberts, will you be my neighbor?
Yeah. Will you be my neighbor? But anyway... I did know that. I didn't correlate the two, but okay. I knew that.
Oh, we knew you knew what, Matt.
It was called Neighbor Discovery, and in IPv4, it's an ARP table.
That's what we do in somebody when we discover our neighbors. Yeah. All right. Well, this is a serious review, darn it.
Okay.
All right. And that's just chapter two. All right. Our old friend IPv4 receives good coverage in chapter three, and it should because that's the title of the chapter. Lucas spent some time in the first portion of this chapter discussing the basic IPv4 networking, about which I won't go into detail, but involves a lot of ones and zeros. The focus shifts to activity on the local machine with local host and loopback. Apparently talking to oneself here is a good thing. Oh, my goodness. I was in a good mood when I was writing this thing, I tell you. That's because I got it done early. And when you get, you know, when you plan ahead and get your work done ahead of time? Oh, my God. It's like the world is just a...
I don't know.
The world was my oyster.
I never get done more than 5 minutes before it's due.
All right. From there, Lucas moves to private addresses and NAT. Of course, that's network address translation. And he said, of course, private addresses and NAT have extended and expanded the lifespan of the IPv4 address pool. Lucas effectively explains NAT and how it works. I'm not going to go into detail. I think everybody understands, you know. You get one public IP address and a whole bunch of private ones.
Right, right, right. And then there's... If you ever looked at the IPv4, all of IPv4, mm-hmm. there are several blocks of IPv4 addresses that are blocked off for private networks. Mm-hmm. But then there are also three /24s that are blocked off for documentation. So if you use all three of those blocks, it only gives you like 700 and some odd addresses. Well, in one of the things I'm doing, I need like 2,500 addresses.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to have to steal some out of the 172.16, I think it is, private address space and use those.
Okay.
Also.
Yeah. The 172, there's a 17 or one, or there's a 10.10.
Yes, I know.
172.16.
But everybody knows that's a private network.
Right. And 172.16.
Right.
That's a
nobody knows
16.
That's a private network, really. Because at work,
it's documented.
No. I know it's documented, but at work, we use that for our backnet. So all of our backups for all the servers and everything run over the 172 network, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So all the machines have a 172 address on it. So our provisioning people, who aren't necessarily the most technical, like when someone just wants to get one of our shared servers on, buy an account on one of our shared servers, they set the whole thing up. And they have notoriously been assigning the 172 addresses lately.
As the public IP?
Yeah.
No. Oh, jeez.
it's not been working out so well.
Wow, two tales from the data center in one episode. Hey, and speaking of address assignment, back in the early days of the interwebs, apparently huge box like 17 was all given to Ford.
Yes.
And like 13 was given to Xerox. I might have those wrong, but I mean, but that's like 13
huge,
dot
huge
whatever.
Blocks.
Huge blocks. And
they've
so,
asked for them back, some of them back.
Have they, I wonder if they've gotten them.
I don't know.
I don't know. So anyway, but,
cause they do keep track of that too. Mm-hmm. Cause we get our IP addresses directly from ICANN. Mm-hmm. Or not ICANN. It's whoever the North American.
Yes, we can.
Oh. Whoever the North American people are, I forget.
NERPA or...
somebody. Yeah. But we get them right from them, and they audit your IPs.
Oh.
If you don't have a certain percentage of your IPs that you already have in use, they won't give you more.
Okay.
They just won't.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
So.
You shouldn't be using it anyways anymore. You should be moving IPv6.
IPv4 forever.
Well, it's easier to remember those addresses.
It's way easier.
Oh my God. But anyway, we're going to move on.
I agree.
We hear the word firewall, and Lucas aptly notes that it can mean several things, from a software package on a desktop to a combination of packet filters, PF, Tony.
Yeah.
Proxy servers and NAT, or in the case, in the case of global organizations. I don't think I made a lot of sense there. I'm happy to say. Lucas cautions, so I'll have to go back and fix that, but Lucas cautions that proxies, NAT devices, and firewalls are not internet security systems. He says they're components of the organization's security policy.
Yes.
And he notes that NAT in particular is not a security mechanism.
Especially NAT. You would not believe
how many... It was broken years ago.
How many idiots think that NAT makes them secure.
Yeah, NAT is not a firewall.
No.
Yeah.
And it's not security.
So a majority of your routers out there, like the older routers especially, only have NAT, and they don't have a security firewall.
They don't have any firewall in them at all.
Yeah. So, but he, throughout the book, I mean, he talks about things like that just to say, you know, you may think this is the case, but it's not. But then he also, goes on to say too, he concludes the chapter, by touching on the two main tools, for troubleshooting IP connectivity. We just talked about ping, of course. Which is for testing the local network connectivity, and then traceroute, which is testing connectivity to networks outside of our local domain. Yeah.
And does he touch on MTR at all?
I think he does later in the book. I'll have to go down there. There's so many tools.
We use MTR at work all the time.
I think he does touch on that.
And we even tell clients when they say they're having connection problems, we tell them go to this page and it's going to instruct you on how to get an MTR and send us the results.
Yeah, I think
MTR.
He does because it's like something trace route.
Matt's trace route.
Yeah, Matt's? Matt Enders?
No.
I was gonna say, well, maybe he doesn't talk about. No, he does talk about that. I think because I remember that. Let's see here. Anyway, I dreamt it.
It's a combination of ping and trace route.
Okay, very good. But more on that later in the book. So oh my God, we're just on chapter 4. I'm gonna kind of move this along, but anyway, so.
Maybe it'll be broken up into two reviews.
So we'll only do a half book review. I know, cause I gotta get going here. Chapter 4, of course, is IPv6. I found it to be very informative, primarily because Lucas does a very good job in describing the essentials, then transitions to the details. Of course, we were bound to run out of IPv4 addresses eventually, and Lucas mentions that Aaron projects, they'll no longer be able to issue IPv4 addresses by April 23rd, 2015. It's like...
Well, in some parts of, like, Asia's been out of IPv4 addresses for a very long time. IPv6 has been used in Asia for a long time.
Yes. He talked about that.
Does he?
Yes, he talks about that because, you know,
when they divided up
blocks.
The IP blocks... Asia had no, they were not technologically advanced at the time, so they gave them a very small block, and now Asia's screaming with technology.
Yeah, and they had to go to IPv6 a while back, so, he talks about that very thing. Let's see here, Anyway, so both protocols have a lot in common. And Lucas says you can almost replace an IPv4 address with an IPv6 address and watch everything work. He also notes an interesting difference between the two for many operating systems. For a while, the last part of the host's IPv6 address could be computed from the network and the card's MAC address. An obvious privacy issue, it's been gradually replaced with non-reversible ways to generate IPv6 addresses. He also talks about NAT in there, and we spent a little time talking about it, so I'm not gonna, oh, by the way, NAT, which was invented as a workaround for the limited number of IPv4 addresses, isn't a part of the protocol, but companies have been clamoring for it. And it's not needed, but you know, it's so entrenched that they just think they need it.
Right. They think they need it for security because they think that they need to obfuscate their IP addresses. And you don't if you have your proper security set up.
Yeah. And then he talks, he kind of takes, the various operating system talks about how, incoming and outgoing and how they're handled. Let's see. Chapter 5, TCP/IP. Lucas makes a distinction between both of those protocols and notes that the acronym really refers to the whole family of protocols related to TCP and IP. It reads like a who's who of acronyms, UDP, ICMP, and the less common SCTP and ESP. Oh, now I understand the protocol for mind-to-mind communication. Okay, I think that's my last joke in this whole review.
All right.
Mr. Lucas spends time discussing each and noting the differences. His analogy of the difference between UDP and TCP is effective, comparing them to cars on a crowded highway versus an automated factory assembly line, respectively. And essentially, you know, when you're on the freeway with a bunch of cars, you're all independent, and, you know, if the car behind you goes off into the ditch, well, I mean, as a human being, you might care, but, you know, you're independent from that. You're just moving along to your destination.
Yeah.
But if you're on a factory assembly line and a component falls off, it's got to be replaced. Yeah. So I thought that was a very effective way of describing the differences. I mean, I kind of knew the differences.
Yeah.
But I, you know, again, he's very good at, analogies, or at least, taking a complex topic and making it understandable for people like me. Let's see here, and the initial reaction to these descriptions is what good is UDP when it's connectionless and doesn't have its own error correction? Well, it turns out, according to Lucas, very good when you're using VoIP. The example he uses, and again, another example, this is perfect. He says, if a phone drops a couple of packets, you don't want the application to say, oh, we lost a quarter second of audio. I better go ask the sender to retransmit those. No, a little slice of sound is gone. The caller doesn't need a 2-second-old drop piece of sound to suddenly be dumped into a blank spot in the conversation.
Right.
That was a perfect explanation of why UDP, I mean, why in some cases UDP is the perfect protocol to use.
Yes.
I thought that was
perfect. Because sometimes you don't give a shit if it gets there.
You don't. I mean, if you're talking and suddenly some little
right,
piece comes
exactly.
back and, you know, so... but that explains why
UDP is great. It's here's a stream. If you catch it, great. If not,
that's
care.
Okay. Yeah. Yep. Anyway, he touches on the other protocols and points the user to the protocol file, which you can view in you can view the list. And the remainder of the chapter is spent discussing TCP/IP. He walks the reader through an overview of setting up the connection, the three-way handshake, and I didn't realize. You start off with a three-way handshake, but you end with a four-way handshake.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
That's what a SYN flood is. A SYN flood is
that
when...
That fourth piece just keeps...
No.
Not
the
letting go of
one.
Your hand
no,
when
no, no,
shaking?
No. It's the first one.
Okay.
They just send a continuous stream of SYN packets
SYN.
With
a stream of SYN.
with spoofed IP addresses.
Okay.
So you get the SYN packet, and it says it's from blah, blah, blah. So you send an ACK back. And that server gets the ACK and goes, I never sent you a SYN. What the heck are you doing?
Okay.
So, and it sits there for up to 3 minutes waiting to get a response back from that ACK it sends.
Wow.
And your contract table just fills up and overflows and no more network connections can be made to that box.
Yeah, I tell you. All right. Anyway, and then in that chapter, you know, no chapter would be complete about TCP/IP without a look at ports and of course sockets. Lucas calls sockets a virtual construction for plugging communication into, and goes on to discuss them and how they're used. And let's see. So there's other protocols covered in that chapter six. We're moving on. Viewing network connections. Now, he discusses the readout from netstat command for both Windows and Unix-like system. He also takes the time to show how various options can be can effectively filter for the information you're seeking.
Yes.
And he goes into, I mean, he really
is
shows
there a,
you.
Is there a long section? Is there a big section on netstat?
Yeah.
Oh, beautiful. I love netstat. I use it. Several of my scripts for work, I use it on the fly.
He takes a number of different options and shows you the readout, explains what you're looking
right,
at.
Because I just always have it send me everything. I do -ULANTP. I just show it all to me, and then from there I filter it out with the rest of the script.
You can customize it. And it was interesting, and this is where I was plugging in. Because he's showing Linux, Unix, and BSD and Windows output, he helpfully organizes the information in this chapter, or in this portion, into separate sections.
Does he note that in Linux, netstat is deprecated?
He notes that something was deprecated.
It's replaced by SS, and has been for a while.
I don't know if he goes into that detail or not. I'm not sure, but there was another one that was deprecated that he talks about. He said that what Microsoft has done for their version of it is they have continued to update it, but in the Unix world, it's been deprecated and they're using something else. So anyway, but when I tried netstat-na-4, it appeared, it produced a very different output on this laptop because it appeared to provide a real-time look at what was passing over my laptop's network connection. It was very odd. It was like it was showing the packet size and all this stuff that was just, I had no idea, but that was the Linux command, so, you know, who knows. I did put a screenshot of it in the notes. let's see, we're moving on to Chapter 7. Okay, this is where we go into troubleshooting. Network testing basics. Again, there are do's and don'ts for troubleshooting. Network testing etiquette, as Lucas calls it. After all, you don't want to create an abnormal situation on your network. Right, Matt?
It's always the networking guy's fault.
Lucas says that it's okay to send normal traffic between your systems for testing, but abnormal traffic is another story. The two tools that can create this kind of traffic, Matt, do you know what they would be?
Wireshark is one of them.
Load balancers and port scanners.
Yeah, Wireshark is a port scanner.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay. I run it, but I'd only just look and see what
Nmap is also.
Yeah, he talks about that too. So he said you probably can create a small amount of abnormal traffic, but if you use the tools to create a large amount, be prepared for a visit. And then he also says potential network issues for system administrators boil down to two key questions. What do my hosts send? And what do my hosts receive? That's what it really boils down to. And let's see here. He also discusses how to report problems because there's a good way and a bad way to report. And it's typically better not to jump to a conclusion about what the cause is. People can take these things seriously or personally.
I just start screaming, the UK's down, the UK's down. That's not the way I do it.
It's effective in its own way. He said the best thing to do is to let the network team know what you're trying to accomplish. Just the facts, sir.
I'm trying to talk to the UK.
Yeah, that's good. And then that chapter concludes with some of the items that can block or disrupt traffic and how they might do it. Now, in Chapter 8, he moves into the DNS, Domain Name System, which I found to be a very interesting chapter. He assures sysadmins they don't have to know the innards of DNS, just the basic idea behind it, and how to query the system for information. For example, DNS runs on TCP and UDP using port 53 on both. It's a common myth that DNS only uses UDP.
I did think it only used UDP.
Yeah. He says that that hasn't been true since the 1990s.
Oops.
And then he covers the concept of domains and zones, child zones, parent zones. And depending on your perspective, you might be a child zone from this angle, but then from the other angle, you're a parent zone. You know, when you're talking about, root zones and all that kind of thing. And then he uses his own site as an example to really kind of drive home the point. He talks about the zone file, and the zone files, you know, they're on the authoritative DNS servers, and there are two varieties, of course, authoritative and recursive. So he goes in and talks about the differences, and also about forward and reverse DNS. As you might expect, one maps host names to IP addresses, and the other does the reverse.
Yes.
Which is which?
You need RDNS to be working for what?
Reverse DNS.
Mail.
Oh, mail. Okay. Oh, yeah, that makes sense. So anyway, but you know, talks about the A record, and then he talked. You know what the IPv6 record is? It's the AA
record.
No, it's the AAA.
A record. Yeah, yeah.
AA. No, four. AAAA record. I'm thinking, but I didn't want to make sure.
There were, there were a bunch of.
Want to be first in the list.
You know what I think? Why they did that?
Why?
It's because IPv6 address is four times longer than. IPv4.
Oh, that, you so know, that's
that actually makes sense.
That does make sense. Yeah. And I have here, I wonder why 4As were used. But
that's
makes sense.
Pure speculation, right, Tony?
Yes. It is.
Okay, that's just speculation.
But that's intelligent speculation, Matt.
It's a networking guy's fault.
All right. But any,
that's right.
All right. Anyway, but he talks about the host, you know, in the Unix world, using the host command. The host?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
I'm familiar with it.
All right. Very good. In Windows, it's NSLookup, but NSLookup is what's deprecated, I think, in Linux.
I don't know. I use NSLookup in Linux all the time, too.
Okay. Well, I think you can. It's just, he said it's deprecated, but Microsoft's updated their version. And then he also provides several sample searches as well as a few suggestions if you need a more sophisticated tool. So read the book.
You can get the same. You can get basically do an NS lookup with Dig too.
Mm-hmm.
Just
I think he mentions yeah because I didn't have time to really
I forget the flag.
I didn't have
right
time
now
to rewrite
offhand.
His book in my review.
Yeah, I forget what flag it is offhand. But if you give Dig a certain flag, it returns the name servers.
Yeah, I tell you, it was just a really helpful book. Let's see here, and then he wraps up that chapter. I talked about the host file and map. You can set up your manual maps in the host file.
Or is it who is? I don't remember.
Well, he wrote the book. All right. Tools to determine what is coming and going on your server are covered in Chapter 9, Packet Sniffing. A chapter titled with the word sniffing in it. You know, did I ever tell you that one of my entertainment characters when I was younger was Sniffy, the tacky party clown?
No.
I did.
And so that's where your fear of clowns comes from.
Yes. Oh, my God. I tell you, I dress up at a Christmas party at work. Oh, it's a wonder I didn't get fired. We'll leave it at that. But anyway, so he talks about the tools, TCP dump, WinPCAP, WinDump, Wireshark. Most are console tools, but Wireshark, of course, has got the interface. So he kind of goes on, talks about all of those. He also emphasizes, for security reasons, Wireshark should never go on a production server.
I was just going to say that. Wireshark is so insecure. Wireshark makes the machine it's installed on, and when it's running.
That's why I took it off my machine.
So insecure that it's not even available in the open BSD repositories.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, I had put it on and I took it off. But he said, what he suggests you doing is just spin up a throwaway virtual machine, run it from there, and then get rid of it later.
Yeah.
See, I mean, you're not going to run it all the time. You're just going to run it when you need to.
Makes sense.
If you've got a bad network, you might be running it all the time. But anyway, so, and then, most of the chapter spent discussing command options available, including filtering for specific protocols, as well as considerable detail on interpreting the results. Chapter 10, we go from analyzing traffic to creating traffic. Reproducing the problem is a valuable troubleshooting technique. And in this chapter, Lucas introduces Netcat, a tool which lets you generate arbitrary TCP/IP traffic. Boy, that'd be a good April Fool's joke for the networking guys, wouldn't it? For example, if you want to know if a client can connect to TCP port 25 and 587 on your mail server, well, stop using your email program to generate traffic. Fire up Netcat on your client, point it at those ports on the server, and see if the packets arrive. That's what he said.
I use Telnet.
All right, which is... I'm going to move on. He notes that Netcat's been around for 20 years. The original versions lacked the IPv6 support, but now it's been fork rewritten and improved by many people. So it's been also ported to Windows. And there are also other Windows tools for generating traffic. He goes into considerable detail. Again, I'm not going to go into that detail, but it's in the book. Get the book. Server packet filtering is covered in Chapter 11. He helpfully provides scenarios where packet filtering can help isolate a problem. Bless you, Matt. Or prevent an intrusion. He says that your server probably runs all kinds of services used only by the local host, and it probably offers all of them on its network interface. So why should other hosts be able to access them? Block that stuff. You know, we really talked about, you know, tightening them down. So block everything except what you really need. And then chapter 12, tracing problems. This is the last chapter. I am reaching the conclusion of my review. In this chapter, he introduces trace route, and describes how to use it and what it can tell you and some of the common errors mean. He explains that it's that more is better as far as trace route is concerned when trying to identify a network problem. This is where MTR comes in. And this is it's called My Trace Route.
Yeah.
Did you say Matt's?
Originally named My, and they changed the name to Matt because that's the guy who wrote it.
Okay. Is a utility that runs traceroute continuously and prints statistics. He also recommends a presentation by Richard Steenbergen from NANOG 47. It's called A Practical Guide to Correctly Troubleshooting with Traceroute. Apparently, it was so good that Michael Lucas removed Traceroute Mastery from his to-do list. That's what he said. In conclusion, there is a lot of useful information packed into this book, whether you're an experienced system administrator or some dabbler like myself. I highly recommend that you get this book. So there you have it.
Yeah, I think I really want to get it.
Yeah. I'm going to buy the print version. I mean, I like the print version.
Yes, I'm getting the print version myself.
So there you have it, everybody.
Excellent, excellent review, Mary.
Yep. Networking for System Administrators by Michael W. Lucas. Buy it.
Is it available now?
The print version is just now getting available, and I am going to order mine today.
I'm going to too.
All right.
So
does he have it on? Is it just on his website,
Amazon?
From his website, you can only buy the ebook, mm-hmm. which is non-DRM. Michael Lucas, all ebooks, non-DRM. If you buy them from his site. Great.
Mm-hmm.
But I prefer the print version, and I got to go get that from Amazon.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where I got the free BSD storage assistance, the free BSD mastery. Yep. Storage mastery? No.
Yeah. Some.
That title. You know that other book.
I know the one you're talking about.
Are those links in there?
They are not. I checked earlier. I'm like, oh, great, does she have a link? And no.
Well, is the page published yet?
No.
Okay. When that page is published, that link will be there.
All right.
All right. All right.
To both Michael's website and Amazon?
Yes.
All right. Excellent.
That's right. And yours if you want one. Bash Junkie.
Yeah. I'm thinking about, I'm going to put it as like my blog. We have those places where we can say things. So
okay. All right. Now, we're moving on.
All right. We're moving on to...
It's time for the tech news of the week.
The news.
The news.
The news.
So, Matt, do you have anything?
I do. I have two stories, both of them pretty much the same topic.
So it's one...
They're both about Lenovo and Superfish.
Oh, yeah. I was reading that.
The first one is... from InfoWorld. Hey, and the second one's also from InfoWorld. And there are links in the show notes for these already, because I plan ahead. But the first one is about the initial one. Lenovo pre-installs man-in-the-middle adware that hijacks HTTPS traffic on new PCs. And it goes on to talk about that. It says, major technology companies just can't help tampering with our web traffic to deliver advertising. Security researchers recently discovered that consumer-grade Lenovo computers ship with software called Superfish Visual Discovery that injects advertising into websites on browsers like Google Chrome and Internet Explorer. Even worse, Superfish installs a self-generated root cert. If you don't know what a root cert is, you don't realize how bad that is.
You know what?
Right. Well, basically what a root cert is it's telling the browser to just accept anything it gives.
Yes, anything signed by this cert is 100% okie-dokie.
Right, so it can give off a Facebook cert, and it'll say, the browser like, oh, okay, that's Facebook.
Yeah.
Or it'll give off anything.
Anything. You can impersonate anything.
I would never buy a Lenovo.
The screenshot in this article showed the guy going to his banking website that the cert was, which was Bank of America, and then it showed the cert that it was using, and it was a Superfish cert. Superfish had hijacked his connection to his bank.
That is.
Yeah. That's really bad.
That is horrible.
Yes.
Why? I mean.
Because you can't intercept and
right,
they put can't, advertising inside an HTTPS webpage.
Right.
Unless you
the only
hijack that whole page.
Right. The only advertising that would be on an HTTPS page is advertising that that page has on it.
Yeah, that server site.
Right.
You would think that Lenovo would conduct the appropriate due diligence for anything that is going to be put on their product, because if something goes wrong, it's kind of like auto suppliers. When there's a recall, they're not saying, well, it's the Delphi such and such. It's the GM.
Well, exactly.
Not to pick on GM, but,
which leads me to my second article.
Okay. What a segue.
Lenovo, we were as surprised as you.
Yeah.
which ridiculous, because if Lenovo really was surprised as everybody else,
that's shameful.
It's worse than shameful. It is irresponsible to the point of criminality. Okay.
Yeah.
And I cannot believe that a company as large as Lenovo is irresponsible to the point of criminality.
Yeah.
They knew it was there. They knew what it did. And Superfish gave them enough bucks that they did it anyway.
Well, keep in mind, too, mm-hmm. Lenovo, I mean, those are made in China.
Whenever,
and that's how China does stuff.
Whenever there's a monetary, monetary driven incentive,
mm-hmm.
People are going to do stuff for that monetary incentive. And
it's capitalism, man.
Exactly. And I'm all for capitalism. Capitalism's great. But when you do things like this and sell me out without telling me you're selling me out.
Yeah, that's, it's full disclosure. I mean,
Now granted, for none of us would this have been an issue, because what's the first thing if you bought a new laptop you do? I never ever even boot it into the operating system. I immediately wipe it and install something else on it.
That's right.
You know. Who this is a problem for is mom and dad.
Speaking of that, you know, it is. Yeah, the folks who just buy a computer because they just want to check their email. You know, I got my, I got that new computer I ordered. You know, it was custom built, and wow, that thing is fast.
Smoking fat.
Oh man. Well, that other one I had, it had four gigs of RAM, but Windows 7 was only using 2.87 of it. There's something, I don't know.
Because you were using the 32-bit version?
Yeah.
Oh, that's why.
Yeah. It was horrible. It was just horrible. And now it's just smoking. Smoking. So, anyway. But the thing of it is, I only mention that because the company, you know, it's specific for financial markets. And so, and this company, doesn't put the bloatware stuff. They only put just the basics on there. So, but I don't do my banking on there. Instead, I log into all my big accounts with my stuff in it. Ooh, no, that makes me nervous now. I don't think they've put a backdoor in there.
You use Linux, though, or PCBSD whenever you're doing any of your banking stuff.
Yeah, exactly. And I prefer, I also do it on a wired connection, too. So.
Oh, that's actually smart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
So anyway, that's my news.
Okay, thanks, Matt.
Yeah.
Links in the show notes to the stories. The second one is especially good if you want to laugh.
Hey, but you know, I think the news this episode is going to really kind of slant toward the security. Did you see that article? It was a few days ago where apparently the largest SIM card manufacturer
in the
world, I think they're based in the
China.
Netherlands.
No,
they're based in the Netherlands.
Yeah, but I thought the factory was in China.
I don't know. Maybe it is. But apparently, U.S. and British intelligence had hacked that network and got the
Eating
keys.
It up.
Oh my god!
Wow, yeah.
So if you have a SIM card, basically the NSA has your key.
Yeah. send a Freedom of Information request out to Utah. I do have one little news article, and this one is Google calls FBI's plan to expand hacking power a monumental constitutional threat.
It's horrible.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Google is warning that the government's quiet plan to expand the FBI's authority to remotely access computer files amounts to a monumental constitutional concern. The search giant submitted public comments earlier this week opposing a Justice Department proposal that would grant judges more leeway in how they can approve search warrants for electronic data. I'll tell you, they, you know, and then when you think about, the body of legislators that are, there's a lot of older folks who...
You know what? That's why I'm a big fan of those signs.
Which signs?
The signs that say, we have not been asked, we have not been presented with a whatever that secret court warrant is,
mm-hmm.
says we haven't been presented with that. And then as soon as you no longer see that sign, that's when you stop doing business there.
Yeah. But anyway, you know, it's just, it's concerning. And so I did get that article, and I'm going to put a link to that in the show notes. Tony?
All right. Well, I found a few things. Actually, I set up my my news aggregator on my own cloud again.
Did you?
Yeah, it's really easy. And there's an app on your phone, so you can just... You manage all of your feeds from one spot. Mm-hmm. You can do it on your phone and any computer you go to.
Don't tell Matt about that because he doesn't like that.
It's really cool.
He can use it all he wants.
But anyway, so I found one that, and they actually talked about it on NPR a lot recently, is mm-hmm. how Obama is encouraging companies to report cyber threats. And I think the idea behind it, the intent, is really cool, where like it'll bring, instead of every individual company managing security threats individually and not talking to anybody else, it's supposed to bring it all together so that whenever one company sees a new security threat,
smoke
then
and mirrors.
Other people would be able to get
yes.
And in this article, actually, it says that if you don't anonymize the data you send, like if the company sends it to Homeland Security for this this new thing, then they said it's not our fault that you didn't anonymize it. Now we have some of your data.
Exactly.
And mirrors. They said, and that's not something that we're going to deal with for a policy. That's something that legislators are going to have to deal with.
Hmm.
It's also that the trench coat guys can get more of your shit. So.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, I think that's where, if it wasn't a government agency running
Trenchcoat
it, if it was
guys.
A nonprofit, then I think that would be better.
Yeah, like in the old spy
movies.
Oh,
I was thinking of the other Trenchcoat guys. I'm sorry, Matt.
Shows you where Mary's mind lives.
Right. Sorry, Tony.
Sorry.
You know, look at that, Matt. Tony's talking seriously, and
blush.
We just...
You made him blush over there, right?
We just...
You did,
We
huh?
just trashed your story. We're very sorry.
I don't know, maybe you're naturally...
Red.
Maybe
in,
these,
in this lighting I am.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really good on your skin, Tony. All right.
So I thought that was it's an interesting idea, like I said, but there's definite problems with it.
Mm-hmm.
And then I had a second story. And where did it go?
It went below the first story. I have no
Del
idea.
Del Null? The bit
oh, actually,
bucket?
No, with the name of it didn't come up right when I placed it in. There's an update on the TrueCrypt.
Oh, yeah. I missed that. What's going on?
That they have finally gotten to the part where they've gotten somebody to agree to continue on with the...
the audit.
The audit?
Yeah, but I...
Because I remember contributing a little bit, I think, to the first phase of it. Do you want me? Well, is that part of your security bit update?
Yeah.
If you want to do that, I can do my cool tool and you come back to it. Are you ready?
Yeah, why don't you do your cool tool?
Okay. So that's the end of the news, the hardcore news. Now we're going on to Mary's cool tool, and then Tony, it'll be your security bit.
All right.
Well, this week's cool tool is a little tool, and actually anybody who's on my Google Plus stream saw this late yesterday. It's called CalCurse. No, as I said yesterday on my Google Plus stream, it's not a utility that helps you curse your calendar when you've double booked yourself. But it,
I want to interrupt for a second, Mary.
Go ahead. Yeah.
I had it backwards.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
I had it backwards.
What's that?
It was bugging me, so I had to look it up. It was originally called Matt's Traceroute. And now it's called My Traceroute.
Oh, okay. Well, no, thanks for setting the record straight.
So I had it backwards. I am sorry.
Okay. That's Matt setting the record straight
segment.
Yeah,
it was bugging me.
Which will probably be a regular segment.
It was bugging me. I'm like, did I remember that right?
That's good. I'm glad to know that. Seriously. All right. So getting on with this cool tool, it's called CalCurse. Now, CalCurse is a text-based calendar and scheduling application. It will help you keep track of events, appointments, everyday tasks. It also has a configurable notification system that will remind you of upcoming deadlines. And the curses-based interface can be customized, and including changing the background color and everything to suit your needs. They've got an online help system, and so what I did is I downloaded it. Now, if you run a Debian-based distro, you should be able to install it from the repository, but I, of course, took the hard route because I didn't know that at the time, and I compiled it from source, but it was so easy. I mean, you just got to have the GCC compiler, right. and
or Clang, probably.
Or, yeah,
Clang
whatever
also
it is.
Work.
Yeah.
Because did you install it on Linux or on PCBSD?
Linux, my home one. But anyway, so... That's what I did to get it on there, and it only took a few minutes because it's a very small program. So to start CalCurse, all you have to do is type the name of the program on the command line, and then what'll happen is you'll get a default layout that will show your appointments listed on the left, and then stacked on the right is your to-do list, and then the upper right corner is the calendar. What you can do then is reconfigure the way that things are laid out if that's not your preference. And there's a tutorial there that will show you how to do that. It also has two modes. It's got an interactive command, I call it interactive command line mode because to get to it, it reminds me of Vi, or, you know, where you do the little colon and then you get in.
Well, in Vi, you get into interactive mode by pressing I, and then you get back into normal mode by pressing...
Yeah, it's the spirit
Escape.
Of that. Yeah, but it's so you can get into that via the keyboard let me just backtrack a little bit. It has two modes. There's the interactive command line mode where you can do the entries just from the command line, or you can just use the various keyboard commands.
Yeah, once it's running, I'm sure it has shortcuts.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what I meant. All right. I see. I spent all my time on that review. I didn't get a chance to really polish this, but it can, and also it can run in the background too, so that you don't really have it up. It's just running as kind of a daemon in the background. Like most tools of this type that are NCurses based, there's a panel at the bottom with the keyboard actions for the mode you're in. The CalCurse websites have some really nice screenshot and other documentation that will show you where you go to configure things, how you can, you know, set various views up and that type of thing. Now, one thing that really wasn't clearly laid out on their website, and I had to poke around a little bit to figure it out, is to add an appointment. When you've got it open, which is how I did it, you just simply hit Control A, and then you just add the appropriate information, start time. Well, first of all, you've got to make sure that the proper day is highlighted for this appointment. And then you just simply add the start time, the end time, what the event is, or, you know, appointment, whatever it is, and then just save it. If you want to add a to-do item, you just do Control T, and it's the same thing. For the to-do list, you have the ability to add a priority to that particular task. So I think anybody who uses a tiling window manager may find this to be a very useful way to track appointments and to-do lists.
Why would the fact that they use a tiling window manager make this more effective?
Because it will just match the rest of their, because if they're running a tiling window manager, they probably have a lot of NCurses apps flying around their desk.
Technically, tiling manager, you can run X. It's X.
You can run X, yes.
And in those tiles, you run X program.
Yes, and I have done that when I reviewed, I think it was it the Awesome Window Manager?
I think what you may be thinking about, or what I would think,
system
is if somebody's running Tmux or Screen,
where you've got a bunch
split it
of
up into multiple.
Yeah,
or maybe that's what it is.
In the same window, then this would be great, because it's still command line based.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for saving me, Tony. That's what it was. But anyway, so there's going to be a link to that site along with a couple of nifty screenshots in the show notes. Again, that's CalCurse. And the site is calcurse.org, CalCurse.org. And that's Mary's cool tool.
All right. All right, so going on to a security bit. and another update on the TrueCrypt audit.
Okay.
And how's
it
going?
Mary's been covering most of these, but I happened to see the article this week. And just as a recap, 2013 was when they started the crowdfunded project to do a audit of TrueCrypt. And if you're not familiar with TrueCrypt is, it's a now defunct or closed project to encrypt, do a full disk encryption of your hard drive or partitions and stuff. And what happened in 2014, they just closed up and said, oh, we're not doing it anymore. Considered insecure. The TrueCrypt did.
Yeah. The maintainers.
So
yeah.
This...
And, the anonymous maintainers?
In 2013 to 2014, before they closed up, they got the part one of the audit done.
Right.
Which was just looking at the basic coding of how the program ran. And part two was going to be looking...
The deep dive.
Yeah, at the cryptography of TrueCrypt. And before they got to that point...
They were killed. They were killed by the NSA.
they closed up shop, and it threw a lot of questions up in the air saying, you know, should we even continue with this?
Right. Or is it really insecure? Did just the TrueCrypt devs not want to deal with it anymore? You know?
Right. What? And then also that now that there's forks of TrueCrypt, which version or what fork or what version are they going to continue their audit on?
Mm-hmm.
And they decided to, now they've decided some of the discussions and they're going to stick with the TrueCrypt 7.1a, which was their latest version before they
folded
up, right? Then they're going to continue from there. They said they to save on money, they didn't set a specific start date, so that's why you haven't seen anything yet. But they are they're going to continue on and look at that. So you can make a decision on the cryptography from the TrueCrypt 7.1a, and the forks from there is you're going to have to then look at those individual ones if, you know, yourself after the audit is done.
Is there any kind of a Kickstarter or donation page to fund the second phase?
There is, and I saw the link on there.
Will it be in the show notes?
Yes, I'll put it in the show notes.
Excellent.
Yes, excellent.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I piggybacked off your comment.
Oh, they said that.
I'm saying the last word of everything you say. The last two words. Last two words.
There's a new nonprofit that's doing this cryptography audit.
Okay.
And it's the NCC Group, Groups Tech Cryptography Services,
mm-hmm.
Which grew out of ISEC. So, yeah.
Great.
Check it out, yeah.
Thank you, Tony.
You're welcome. Initial... No, I don't even see that link. It says that they are continuing to accept, but maybe it's on this page. But, all right.
All right.
So, what's up next?
Listener
feedback. And
it's listener feedback time.
And that phone number is 734-258-7009.
And someone used a new number.
They did.
And then complained about it.
That's right. Because our last couple ones, I forgot to cut that out. And it showed and it played the old phone number.
Oh.
I
thought, oh, yeah, we should just chop that thing.
Tony has fixed it now.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good.
Now the Trucker Rich has said, your freaking number's wrong.
Yeah. And that is, we heard from Trucker Rich.
That's
which
right.
Which was good to hear from him.
I'm trying to go back to that email. Where is it at? It came in just hours after our show last time, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Or was it a week after?
I don't know. I thought it was right away because you posted the show like last week, like an hour after we were done. So
yeah.
Yeah.
I emailed it to you guys. Where's...
Oh, you did email it, and I think, I believe that I have it.
Yeah, I have it.
I have it in my voice now. I just got to find where that
okay.
Link is.
I think, anyway,
I accidentally deleted it. Oh, you know what? I did delete it because I'm like, Tony's always got a copy.
I think this is it.
I think there's a fatal flaw in that line.
Yeah, here it is. Okay. We'll play a little bit of the beginning, but do you want me to play the whole?
No, because it was quite lengthy.
And it cut him off.
Yeah.
Apparently Google Voice has a 3-minute cap.
A lot of answering places have a 3-minute cap.
For future reference.
So put a timer on. After 3 minutes, hang up and then call us back and finish your thought.
My voicemail for my phone has a 3-minute cap. If you go longer than 3 minutes, it cuts you off.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Cause anybody leaving a 3-minute long message, God, you just don't need to hear the rest of it after 3 minutes. Just go away.
Should just be a regular conversation.
My mom often gets cut off. No.
So it's kind of like a TLTL. TLTLT.
Too long didn't listen.
Too long to listen to.
Too long to listen.
All right.
Hey, Sunday morning, Linux Review gang. It's Trucker Rich here, and I just had a few things to say real quick. First of all, Tony, congratulations on the house. I encourage everyone to call the number and congratulate Tony on his new house. It's always exciting when you move into a new place like that. Also, I missed the old number. It was underappreciated. Let's run it down real quick. 313 times 2 is 626. Everyone knows somebody that drives a Mazda 626. How easy is that to remember? 313-626. And then 9140. I mean, you can make a little jingle. In 1991, I was sitting on a park bench drinking a 40, watching Star Trek. I like Jordy. I don't know. You make up your own rhyme. Don't rely on me. But anyway, now I don't even know what this new number is. It's hard to remember, that's for sure. Alright, now, a while back, Bruce Perens. Everybody, you could tell people who Bruce Perens is. Maybe Matthew knows or something. He called all the BSD users chumps. Now, maybe not all the users, but he certainly called people who submit code under the BSD license a bunch of chumps. That's Bruce Perens calling people who write code under BSD a bunch of chumps. Does that make people who use BSD a bunch of chumps? Does that mean Mary is a chump? Since y'all been talking about BSD a lot on the show, I was wondering if you had an opinion on this. He said this. I've listened to him a couple of times. Couple different conferences that he's given talks at, talking about Bruce Perens now, and it seems to me that he is an opportunist. You know, he goes out and makes his money on companies that are non-compliant in the GPL, and he helps them get into compliance. So, of course, he'd call anybody with a BSD license a chump, because he wouldn't make any money off of those people that is using BSD code, because it's all wide open, you know? So, of course, he wants all the code to be GPL, because then he can go out and make some money off of it. So I'm just wondering what y'all think. I know people hold Perens up as an idol or a god or something to be worshipped or whatever, but to me, I don't know. I think it's going down the wrong road. But anyway, wondering what y'all think about that. And that was a ham radio conference where he said that. He was talking about, his new company that he was going to start. Anyway, Ham Radio Now, I think is what the show was. It was like episode 170 or something like that. Somewhere around in there. You could look around and probably find it. Anyway, I hope y'all are having a good day. I'm up here in Wyoming. I'm a regional driver. Wyoming, western Nebraska, Colorado, and western Kansas. That's about the only places I ever get.
I totally agree with his opinion on Bruce Perens. Are we going to include his old message in the show, or are we going to have it as an extra download that people can get? Because he hits the nail on the head with Bruce Perens, I think. He's right up there with Stallman. Mm-hmm. They both need to go.
I'll just paste it right in with the whole show.
Okay.
It'll be put right in.
Yeah, I think that'd be good. So thanks for calling, Trucker Rich. We appreciate it, like we always do.
Yeah. Yeah, anybody else want to call in?
Yeah.
And it might be hard to remember, but if you look at your numpad, it's an arrow down. 258 is down the center. On a computer, or on a phone, not on a computer.
I was going to say on my computer, it goes
on
up.
On the computer, yeah.
Backwards.
It's 258-7009, so it's like an arrow. On a phone number pad. But.
Okay.
All right.
All right.
That kind of is.
I have to go.
I can totally see that.
All right.
Mary's class was supposed to start a half hour ago.
It did start a half hour
That's
ago.
That's right. And I'm not there. In my seat. All right. And I think we got something from Guillaume.
Yes.
Yeah, various stuff.
Our friend Guillaume.
Yes.
I say various stuff because that's what he actually named his email.
Various stuff.
Yes, he did. And he talked about the footnoting. I think he had an example of one that he had used, or at least
the Zentro?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then he talked about Tarsnap. Do I have that right? I think I don't have it open. I do recall that discussion with Tarsnap. And then the free file sync, which apparently he used on the front end to prepare the file, and then it goes up to Tarsnap. So I thought that was a kind of interesting approach, and I want to look into that. So Guillaume, thanks for writing in. And then he also talked about that, not the Raspberry Pi, but it was another...
Raspberry Pi 2.
Yeah, he talked about
another... And the Odroid
C1. Yes, I took a look at that.
I don't think he uses FreeNAS. He mirrors everything to his FreeNAS server.
Oh, did I have that wrong?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I wasn't looking at it, so I was...
No,
from that faulty memory.
He talks about all of that.
He does talk about Tarsnap Fader further down, but...
Okay. Well, there, I just forgot that other FreeNAS piece. So...
All right. And then we've had a
number of comments on our site.
Yeah. One comment was spam. Scott emailed in about the missing link for the MDP. Did you put that in the old show notes, or did you just email him back?
I emailed him back, and then I also put it in the show notes. I uploaded it, so it's in the show notes.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it's in the show notes. Mary sent about course. We had a listener or a note in the or a comment on the webpage, and I don't know if it was approved or not. I got to get in and check that.
I wouldn't approve. I approved one this morning that was sitting there.
Okay, and it's basically the links again or for MDP, and there's a project page, a demo page,
apparently,
and the
people,
page.
Yeah.
I think
somebody
Matt
provided
use
some...
this as his. Presentation software.
I vote for that too.
I will look into it.
I think
because right now my entire presentation is written up in plain text format and Kwrite.
Oh, you
and it
should.
Says slide one on slide notes, slide two on slide notes. Slide.
You should look into that program because you can do some cool little things, but it's just looks
can
like
I,
a terminal.
Because like when I use LibreOffice and make my presentation in LibreOffice, I can do things like. Have a block of text, and then I'll make another piece up here underneath of it, and then a little further after I've talked a little bit, another
fly-ins,
piece will appear.
Yeah, animations.
Yeah, but not for the whole slide.
Each bullet
I don't
comes
care
in.
I don't care if the bullet's flying or not. I just want them to not be on the screen, and then after I've said something, then for them to appear.
Well, I think what you just simply do is make four slides: one with one bullet, one with two bullets.
That's just a pain in my ass.
Okay.
Although you, Matt,
I don't know.
Kwrite doesn't do that either.
I know, but then I take what I have in Kwrite
is my
outline, and I do it in Kwrite first so that I can scroll back because I did it last night where I took my slide 7 and now moved it and is now my slide 8-19. You know what
okay,
I mean?
Sure.
So
yeah, I don't know. I don't see it. I mean, I'm looking at a.
I'll look at it for sure because it's definitely interesting. It definitely fits with my presentations. So
yeah. All right. What else do we have?
I have to go back several weeks to...
What?
Tom. Tom...
Friend of the show, D? Tom D?
No.
Oh, okay.
Tom B. And he asked about using Glacier for backups.
Oh, yeah.
And scripting it.
Yes.
And I did a little looking into it, and...
You were wrong?
I don't think it can be done easily.
Oh, okay.
I definitely think you should look at Tarsnap. Okay,
because
it's much easier to do, and Michael Lucas has a book coming out on it.
Yes, he does.
Shortly. I think the ebook version of it's going to be out sometime this month.
Yeah, that's what, that's what he said.
Yeah, and the print version next month.
And I wonder what the cover's gonna look like, cause, you know, on the cover of that sysadmin book, it had like these mushrooms. Let me just explain what I first thought. I first thought, okay,
now
it's the old...
You gotta be on psychedelics to understand that working.
Not those kind of mushrooms. No, I thought it was because, you know, the poor sysadmins on network, they're in the dark and, you know, the network people feed them a little crap every once in a while, keep them in the dark. But no, it's the interconnectedness of the mushroom patch.
Do you know why he chose that, though?
No.
Because the largest living organism anywhere in the world
is in the UP.
Is a fungus.
In the UP.
Is it in the UP?
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was in Oregon.
No. UP.
You sure?
I'm doing a math. Yes.
Okay, I'll defer to you on this one, Mary.
All right. That's a bet.
No.
Conviction convinces. No, I at one time, the biggest one was in the UP. And that, for people who may not know, that's a shorthand for Upper Peninsula.
Yes. The people who live above the bridge, unlike us trolls.
Trolls who live below the bridge. I refuse to be a troll. All right. What else we got?
I think that's it. We got a song.
We got a cool song.
Yeah, it is very cool.
Matt will like it.
Oh, I hate when people tell me that. It makes me want to just not like it on general principle.
All right. You're going to hate this song, man.
Okay.
All right, Tony, you going to...
All right, I'm bringing it up. Oh, first we need our soundbite.
Featured music of the week.
And this song is by Circus, C-I-R-C-U-Z, and it's called Amagita.
Amagita?
Amagita. I don't know, they're from Miami. I'll leave it at that. Here you go.
We can hum.
While we're waiting for it to load up. By the way, if you decide to listen to any of this other music,
oh, we
it's
never
not like
my
this
shirt.
One.
Oh!
For those of you watching on the live feed, I am wearing a Hawaiian shirt in case you saw
how would you
this.
Like a nice Hawaiian punch?
No, thanks. And for those of you listening, I am also wearing a Hawaiian shirt.
Yeah. It's very...
Now, there could be two reasons for this. The first reason could be that I am totally sick of this winter. We've had a very, very cold couple of weeks here in Detroit, and I'm ready for the warm weather, and I'm trying to bring it on by wearing my Hawaiian shirt. Or the alternate answer is, I haven't done laundry in 4 weeks, and this was the only clean shirt I had left.
I'm going with that one.
Right.
I'm going with that one, Matt. I just can't
You'd
help myself.
You'd be a wise person.
You smell okay, though.
Well, I've showered. I just haven't done laundry.
All right. You haven't showered your clothes. You've showered
Correct.
You.
You're right.
Oh, there's an efficiency. Just wear them.
Wear them in the shower.
Okay. All right, Tony, how you doing there? We've stalled long enough because you saw where we went with it.
Yeah, and here we go. So that's cool stuff. If you happen to look at his other stuff on Jamando,
we don't encourage you to.
Not exactly family friendly. No, I encourage it.
I like the song. I mean, I like
my kind of music, but it's good. You know, I mean, if I were into rap and that kind of music, then
rap.
Yeah, that's his other.
Oh,
because that wasn't rap.
No,
and it's not
it was
family friendly.
Good electronic.
It's just parental advisory all over it. There's a lot of cursing. And
in other words, it's probably good music.
Yeah.
This is the only song out of all of his music.
All right. Well.
Anyway, it's very cool. So take a look at that. And so we've come to the end of the show. You've been listening to the Sunday Morning Linux Review. This was episode 145.
Yeah, I was going to say, we went back in time like several
weeks.
He was
closer than when he was the first time he said it.
Right, 145.
We're back?
It's back.
It's back.
It's back.
It's back.
Well, we're back doing it. We'll be back, hopefully.
In 2 weeks.
In 2 weeks, that's right.
That's right. This is Tony Bemis.
Matt Enders.
And Mary Tomich.
Saying see you next time.
Bye-bye.
The Sunday Morning Linux Review with Mary Tomich, Tony Bemis, and Matt Bender.
Bite my 8-bit metal ass. That's bite with a Y.
The Linux Link Tech Show, live every Wednesday, 8:30 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. Tune in to the world's longest-running Linux podcast. On the web, www.tllts.org. By email, techshow@thelinuxlink.net. IRC channel, thelinuxlink.net, port 6667/techshow. And Flying Rich is so hot.
Hi folks, this is Chatter. Gay Wisher Honky Magoo 5150 and I have started a new podcast. Yeah, I know we should have gotten Brian Lunduke to do the voiceover, but he wanted a script and none of us are any good at scripting language. Anyway, it's Linux Lugcast. We're at linuxlugcast.com, IRC channel, pound Linux Lugcast on Freenode. We record on the first and third Fridays of the month, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 0200 UTC. We talk about things we've tried, things we got to work, things we failed to get working, things we built, and things we broke. Email us at feedback@linuxlugcast.com, and if we don't know the answer, we'll just tell you to install Arch. That's a joke, son. So join us as we stifle the outcry of voices everywhere for another Linux podcast.
Linux Luddites is a show where we try out all the latest free and open source software and then decide we like the old stuff better.
More than just news and releases, we check out a wide range of Linux distros, cover your feedback, talk about obscure command line programs, discuss burning issues over a pint, and much, much more. So join me, Paddy.
And me, Joe, every 2 weeks for news, reviews, comment, and generally being grumpy at LinuxLuddites.com.
Linux Luddites, because not all change is progress.
Open source, Linux, computers, electronics, science, and amateur radio. We cover it all. Who are we? We are Linux in the Ham Shack, the podcast that brings you and your technology together with the power of software freedom. Drop us in your favorite podcatcher or join us every other Tuesday night for the interactive live show. Visit lhspodcast.info for all the details, news, and information. We are Linux in the Ham Shack, and we want to open your mind.